You're listening to MLB.com Extras, brought to you by MLB.tv. It's baseball everywhere.
On this week's edition of the NL Central Podcast, Gerrit Cole reminds baseball he is still Gerrit Cole. Even more injury issues for the Cincinnati Reds pitching staff, and the Chicago Cubs decide to get their first two-game losing streak out of the way within the same day. We kick things off this week with Pirates reporter Adam Berry. Adam, I think for the first time this season following Sunday's win against the Cubs, Pirates fans able to say, now that is Gerrit Cole. I think his first really dominant start of the season, and not just dominant, but dominant against baseball's best team, at least the team with baseball's best record in their backyard in Wrigley Field. And I think that's the Gerrit Cole that we've been kind of waiting to see all season.
Yeah, that looked a lot more like an ace than just the number one starter, if that makes any sense. That looked like a guy who's capable of handling any team on any day. He did it against a lineup that had kind of given him fits a couple starts ago. Just went out there and against a pitcher in John Lester was throwing a no-hitter for most of the afternoon. It just spoke volumes about Cole, what he's capable of doing. It's a huge performance. The team needed it, whether they would admit it or not. It was a big spot for it. He looked great. Hopefully for the team, something that he can carry over into his next couple starts because they could definitely use that guy to shore up what has been really an otherwise incredibly unsteady rotation.
Yeah, Cole was simply sensational. And like you said, it was kind of an odd game because going into the seventh, here's John Lester, eight outs away from his second career no-hitter. But in watching the game, I kind of had the feeling that, you know what, yes, the Pirates are getting no hit, and they have a big fat goose egg in the hits column on the scoreboard. But to me, it didn't feel like they were getting no hit because it was a scoreless game, because it was a pitcher's duel between Lester and Gerrit Cole. Did it kind of have that same feel to you watching things unfold?
Yeah, and, it would have the tendency, fans would think that it was going to get out of hand just because you're coming off of a game where Jake Arrieta pitched and he pitched, so well, even though he did actually finally give up a couple runs. But you know what? You're always in a game so long as your starting pitcher is throwing like that. And I think that's something that's kind of gotten away from the Pirates a little bit this season. Yesterday was the first time that they've won a game scoring fewer than four runs this season. They'd scored fewer than four runs 11 times a season, lost every game. The bats have really carried the pitching so far. So for them to have that kind of game where the starting pitcher takes over, steps up, and says, really acts like a stopper, I mean, I think that was big for the team just to to keep their confidence up. It was big for Cole's confidence. It was big for, really more than anything, I think, for the fan base, just to see, hey, this team can beat the Cubs.
And they did so for the first time in six tries this season. That was a victory that they desperately needed. The Pirates winning 2-1 yesterday over the Chicago Cubs. And in that seventh inning, when Lester lost the no-hitter to Starling Marte, later on in that inning, I believe he got Francisco Cervelli for the second out. Cervelli, a right-handed bat. Now, at this point, Lester's pitch count is well over 100. Up comes another dangerous right-handed bat in the form of Jung O-Gong. Were you surprised at that point that Joe Maddon did not get Lester from the game, get a right-hander to face Gong? How did you kind of assess that?
Maybe a little bit, but John Lester, to that point, he'd been, so good throughout the game, and he's a veteran guy. He's somebody that you trust, even when the pitch count's getting up there. He's kind of a horse-type guy. You're maybe not predicting home runs in that situation, certainly. They could have gone and gotten a right-handed reliever, but really, is there, other than Rondon, a right-handed reliever on that Cubs staff who you trust more than John Lester to get out anybody? I don't necessarily know, but Jung Ho came through in another big moment. That's something he's done a lot of, and really just a week with the team so far. Started off, I believe it's eight hits and six of them for extra bases, eight RBIs in eight games. Really just an encouraging start for him, and then delivering in a big moment, which is something that he's proven before. I think somebody asked Clint Hurdle after the game, hey, it's just kind of unbelievable what Jung Ho Kang's done so far, right? And Hurdle goes, no, it's believable. Because, that's just kind of what they've seen from Jung Ho during his first year plus in the majors.
Yeah, he's already developed quite a track record for coming through in the clutch. You go back to his first game this season, coming off that long injury layoff, and he belts two home runs, like he wasn't off for any time at all. And then the big clutch double yesterday against John Lester to get the Pirates on the board, give them a 1-0 lead. How much of a boost, not just statistically, but just his presence in the locker room and being around the guys, how much of a boost has he provided for the Pirates?
Oh, a lot. He's really well-liked in the clubhouse. Even David Freese, when we talked to him in St. Louis, essentially when Jung Ho came back, you knew that he was taking a lot of playing time away from Freeze, and nobody was happier to see him come back healthy from what he went through than David Freeze was. You know, he's gotten to know him a little bit in spring training. They're living across the hall from each other in Pittsburgh. Jung Ho's just a really likable guy. He's got a great personality, really upbeat, and it helps when you hit the way that he does, certainly. But, yeah, it's just been a big lift, I think, overall for the team, which generally is sort of coming back into the shape that the, you know, the front office originally intended. You're starting to see the bullpen fall back in order, starting to get, you know, you finally have a balanced bullpen and bench. I think overall, like, especially with Jung Ho back, the team is starting to kind of take the shape that they intended. They just sort of need to get the results back on track with what they'd hoped for as well.
Yeah, his return has stabilized so much on that team, not just with position players, but like you said, having that trickle-down effect to the bullpen and the overall roster construction as well. A very welcome presence has Jung Ho Kang been for this Pirates team. Adam, I want to go back to Gerrit Cole just for a second. I caught a headline this morning on this Monday that he had some rather interesting post-game comments following those eight dominant innings against the Cubs, where he was prompted by a reporter about, you know, well, what do you think of the Cubs? They're, you know, baseball's best team. They're running away with everything. They've got a run differential of a million or something like that. You know, they've been great. And Cole kind of said, well, they're good, but I don't think they're baseball's best team. I mean, it's not. I don't think it was a real inflammatory comment, but in this day and age where people are so careful about what they say, that kind of does qualify as bulletin board material. What did you make of that comment from him?
Yeah, well, full disclosure, I wasn't actually in Chicago this weekend. I had the series off, but I watched and I read the transcript, listened to the post-game commentary. And my take on it was that, you know, somebody was asking, you know, does this mean anything more that you come out and you have this performance against the best team in baseball? And those words are going to catch anybody's attention, especially Gerrit Cole. He's super competitive. He doesn't necessarily take kindly to other people complimenting another team, especially a rival, over his. So I think his response was more just saying it's not that it meant more because they're the best team in baseball. That was, I think, maybe some of the meaning behind it. But straight up, he did say, I don't think they're the best team in baseball. But is he supposed to say that? Is he supposed to come out and say, man, the Cubs are so much better than us? I mean, any competitor, I think, wants to believe that you're the best. Otherwise, you wouldn't have gotten to this level. You wouldn't be the kind of pitcher that Cole is if you didn't inherently believe that you deserve the best, or that you have the most talent, or whatever, however you want to put it. So, I mean, of course, that kind of comment is going to gain attention. It's going to be big on Twitter, where, you know, 140 characters or less, not a lot of room for nuance and detail and things like that. But I mean, I think it's another good moment, honestly, for the clubhouse too, to come out and say that. You know, to say we're not going to take anything from these guys, because the Cubs had pushed them around for five games in a row, and it really looked kind of hopeless to a certain extent, you know, in a small sample size. So, you know, Cole, it would mean a lot less, too, if he hadn't backed up the words with his performance. So I think overall, Cole really put a foot down in a number of ways against the Cubs, starting with his pitching and then finishing sort of with that comment.
Yeah, and it's great to see, like you said, for not just his teammates, but for the fan base as well, that, you know what, this guy's not going to take any crap from anybody or any team, any opponent. He's going to say what he thinks, and what he thinks is, yeah, the Cubs are good, but they're not the best. I went out there and I proved it today. So good for Gerrit Cole. I want to get your take, too, on some comments made following Saturday's game, which the Pirates lost 8-2. But after the game, some of the Pirates were kind of accusatory of Jake Arrieta of intentionally throwing at Jung Ho Kang. Now, my personal take, I didn't think there was any intent there. I think most fans didn't think there was any intent because, you know, we know the kind of pitcher that Arrieta is. The Pirates' take was, well, he's got pinpoint control, and now this pitch gets away from him. You know, there's got to be something fishy going on there. What side of the fence do you fall on here?
Kind of hard to say, because you could see the cause in the sense that they've had some bad blood with Arrieta going back to last season in the wild card game especially. They don't like the guy. He probably doesn't like them. And again, yeah, Arrieta's command is just so incredible. That's one thing the Pirates always talk about when they're asked how he's so good, is that he dots the glove. No matter where it is, he finds it. So to see a pitch like that get away from him in the way that it did, basically right between the letters with Jung Ho, it was a little suspicious, especially given the history. That said, and I think this was Joe Maddon's defense, he did come back and walk Jeff Locke, the pitcher, on four pitches, which is also kind of an uncharacteristic loss of command for him. I just think given the circumstances, the history, the bad blood, and the situation, it did seem a little mysterious. Nothing out of the ordinary, nothing worth getting too upset over. It didn't hurt him. But I would probably fall a little bit more in line with the Pirates in that situation. That it was a little odd, at the very least.
Yeah, and it's something to keep an eye on as the teams, engage in their next, 13, 14 battles throughout the regular season here when Arrieta takes them out for the next time. But you know what? It's good for us, right? It's good to report on. You've got these storylines going on, this bad blood, this animosity. So it's something fun to watch develop over the course of the regular season. And speaking of rivalries and animosity, we certainly have that in spades between the Pirates and the Cincinnati Reds, as we saw in abundance on Wednesday night. The Pirates defeated the Reds 5-4, but the story was all the HBPs flying all over the place. Tucker Barnhart, the Reds catcher, a rather amusing explanation after the game. He said, well, the weather was warmer, the ball was slick, and it was tough to get a grip, and I kind of rolled my eyes at that. Clint Hurdle, on the other hand, I think he kind of had to bite his tongue and say, you know, when he heard of Barnhart's comments, and, you know, he's like, come on, that's a ridiculous explanation. So, you know, in your eyes, covering this team and this rivalry, does this enhance or detract from what is already a very intense rivalry between these two teams?
Yeah, I mean, I think it's no surprise that you're going to see a lot of hit batters every time the Pirates and Reds play. The funny thing is that nobody really got too amped up during that game by all the HBPs. It was, you know, some of them were off-speed pitches where you're going to say, all right, that did actually just get away. The one that seemed intentional was the one that Ross Ohlendorf got ejected for. So I think that one kind of made sense. The Pirates' concern, if anything, is just that this is going to escalate and people are going to feel obligated to keep, you know, hitting each other, and then somebody's going to get hurt. And the most common target for a hit-by-pitch, really, I think more than anybody other than the Rays' Brandon Guyer, is Starling Marte. Starling Marte is one of their best, most important players, and you can't risk him getting a broken hand or a fractured rib or something just because there's this kind of nonsensical beanball war going on between the two teams. I don't think they were too worked up about that particular game. The number itself is ludicrous when you look back on it, but if you break down each specific instance, there were only really one or two that would strike you as kind of unnecessary or cause for concern, and you know, one of them is Marte, and then the other one was the last one of the game, and they'll be responded accordingly, and I believe handed out a brief suspension to both Ohlendorf and Brian Price. So it was handled well. It's something to keep an eye on, but I think I tweeted at some point during that series, it's death, taxes, and hit by pitches in a Pirates Red series.
Jennifer, we thank you for the time, as always. And last night, Sunday night's a solid win for the Cardinals. They defeat the Dodgers 5-2. As the Cardinals avoid what would have been a three-game sweep. And the defining moment of that game, the tie-breaking two-run pinch-hit double by Yadier Molina in the seventh inning as the Cardinals took the lead and never looked back. And I know that Mike Matheny really wanted to give Yadi the full night off, the veteran with a lot of miles on his odometer. But, Yadi comes through, Cardinals win the game, and everybody comes out smelling like roses. So not the worst thing that Yadi did not have the full game off, I guess.
No. I mean, the situation called for his bat. You know, we've talked about the Cardinals playing chess in the clubhouse these days. I mean, Mike Matheny made some chess moves last night in the seventh inning that paid off. I mean, he outmaneuvered Dave Roberts. We saw him send up the left-handed hitting Brandon Moss as a pitch hitter for Eric Fryer. It kind of put the Dodgers in a predicament to whether they pitch to him or walk him. They opted to walk him and face Yadi Molina instead. And 7-for-24 in his career against Joe Blanton, Yadi gets hit number 8. So, I mean, I think one of the storylines for this team over the first 6 weeks has been Yadi's success offensively. I mean, let's not forget that 3 months ago when the Cardinals opened spring training, we didn't even know if Yadi would be on the field for opening day. And certainly the expectation was that even if he were going to be able to play, it'd be more, you know, he'd bring some defensive assets, but it was kind of the offense would come along slowly. So much for that theory. He's had one of the best starts of his career. He's on pace to hit over 50 doubles. And really, you look at how he profiles offensively now, very much similar to the 2012-2013 years that he had in which he finished top 4 in the MVP voting both years. So incredible to consider how far he's come when he had 2 offseason surgeries on his thumb. Strength is not an issue. He's driving the ball. And as we've seen for many years, he's coming through with big hits time and time again.
I mean, the guy's a machine, and he's proven that for so many years now. Yadier Molina getting it done defensively, as always, and as you said, offensively, which is, you know, a bit surprising considering the ailments he's gone through. But, you know, Jennifer, as strange as this might sound, for a guy at this stage of his career, for a guy in his mid-30s with so many miles on him, as we've discussed, can it almost benefit a guy in that stage of his career where, I mean, yes, you're injured, but at the same time, you're not playing, you're not exerting energy, so maybe that rest can benefit you, again, as you creep up on your mid to late 30s.
Yeah, I mean, I think that's a fair point. I mean, he did. He had a lot of rest this winter. You know, he was smart about how he spent his time in terms of keeping his body in really good shape. I mean, I think we look at kind of these last 2-3 years for him and how he's transformed his body. He's slimmed down, and all that was, you know, kind of him having the foresight to see, like, you know, what do I need to do to stay on the field? And he knows how valuable he is, and, you know, the fact that he hasn't been on the field in either of the final games of the Cardinal season the last 2 years in October, I mean, that weighs heavily on him. So, yeah, I mean, I think the rest is a help. He just knows himself so well. I mean, that's a product of being in this league for so long and just kind of being as conscientious as he is. So, you know, it's interesting that you think back, too, to this time last year and kind of the strength problems he had in his other thumb, which was also recovering from thumb surgery that previous winter. And so I think there was just, again, that expectation that, you know, when he was going to go through this all over again, there would be no way that he could come out of the gates as strong as he has. So kudos to him. You know, this narrative about the Cardinals getting old, I mean, you could look at Adam Wainwright's struggles and wonder if he's on the decline. But I think when you look at Yadi Molina, this is a guy that still looks like he has plenty of time left in this game.
Yeah, no signs of slowing down. And for a guy like that, age is certainly just a number, as the saying goes. He's still got plenty left in the tank, does Yadier Molina. And Jennifer, switching gears here a little bit, it seems like Mike Leake has kind of turned a corner the last couple weeks or so. You check out the numbers, his first half dozen starts this year, an ERA over 6, his last two starts, including last night against the Dodgers, an ERA under 1.3. Now, what's interesting to me, both of those starts have come in California against the Angels and the Dodgers, and it just so happens that Mike Leake is a California kid, so is this a case of a guy getting a little more amped up to pitch in his home state in front of presumably a lot of friends and family, or do we see signs here that this could be a permanent turn of a corner outside of this little run that he's made in the state of California, I guess?
Yeah, his family was there this most recent start, so I mean, that I think is always a plus. But I think, you know, I think you look at Mike Leake's season, and certainly, you know, we highlight that he was winless in his first 6 starts. But there was a lot to like in those 6 starts. I mean, you kind of looked at, he had runs where he was very, very efficient, where he got so many ground balls, which is, and he's a guy who's putting the ball on the ground, you know things are going well. And then he'd have one kind of complicated inning that was kind of unraveled, 3 or 4 runs would score, and, you know, he'd suffer the loss. So it really had kind of been, you know, a 1 or 2 inning thing for him, a blip on the radar. That's what he was able to prevent his last 2 times out, 14 innings, 2 runs allowed in those 2 starts in Southern California. We see the ground ball rate has risen a little bit. The line drive rate has decreased a little bit. Both very good signs for Mike Leake. I think, too, you look at his efficiency, another positive going forward. I mean, yesterday he lasted only 6 innings. That had nothing to do with him. That had everything to do with the Cardinals wanting to pitch at Yadi Molina in his place. And I believe Mike Leake was around 71 pitches at the time. So he's getting outs quickly. He's putting balls on the ground. He's also not struggling pitching out of the stretch anymore, which, again, led to some of those complicated innings. A base runner or two would get on, and then all of a sudden there'd be 3, 4, 5 hits in a row. He'd look up and be staring at a 4-run deficit. Now when runners get on, he's able to strand them there. And I think all these are positive signs going forward. And, you know, quite frankly, I think we expected Mike Leake to come around. This is a guy who has a track record of success. I don't think we were ready to necessarily jump to any conclusions 1 month into a 5-year deal. But that being said, too, the ability to finally get a win against the Angels, I think, has to allow him to relax a little bit and now just go out and pitch.
And exactly. And the emergence of Leake the past couple starts, even more important given the struggles, as you touched on briefly a moment or two ago, of Adam Wainwright. He did not pitch in the Dodgers series, but he got beat up pretty bad against the Angels this past Thursday. And for all these shocking stats that we see in the 2016 season, for my money, this is the most shocking. Of 103 qualified starting pitchers in the big leagues, Adam Wainwright ranks 101st in ERA, which now stands at 6.80. Only Willie Peralta and maybe Jake Peavy, I'm sorry, are worse than Wainwright right now. And, you know, when you look at Wainwright, are we approaching the point where you can't just chalk it up anymore to a guy off to a slow start. And do you have to consider the possibility, at least, that there's a much more serious issue at hand right here?
Yeah, I mean, it's a little perplexing because I think there were high expectations for him coming into this year, not just because of who he is, but also the fact that his injury last year was not arm-related. So there were not issues about, you know, was his arm going to respond? Was he going to be healthy in that regard? So to see him come out the way he has, and you know, particularly that last start that he had really had three decent starts, kind of stepping stones, three previous starts. And then his last outing was, you know, just a dud, and, you know, and he admitted as much afterwards. His pitches just aren't crisp. He's not getting the life on them that he used to. His curveball is not tight enough, and it's definitely not the consistent pitch that he's, you know, relied upon throughout his career. I do think at some point you have to wonder, you know, whether Adam Wainwright is ever going to pitch like an ace again. And you hate to say that, but you look at his age, you look at the wear and tear, you look at the injury history that he has, you know, how good realistically is he going to be? Now, that being said, he absolutely should be better than a pitcher with a 6 ERA, and I do think he will be. And, you know, you do want to give Adam Wainwright the benefit of the doubt. He is a guy who can make one mechanical change and things click, and then he can score. So, you know, as Matt Holliday told me the other day, Adam is the least of our worries. But that being said, 6 weeks into the season, we're still talking about these struggles. I think at some point you do wonder, again, is he going to pitch like a top-of-the-line starter again? So, certainly, if you look at the Cardinals, who have hovered around 500 all year, I think you can pinpoint the rotation as probably the biggest reason why. I mean, their defense has struggled, but their rotation with Mike Leake going winless for so many starts open this season, then Adam Wainwright not being the ace the Cardinals expected. That's one of the reasons why the Cardinals have fallen back as far as they have in the division.
Kerry, let's look back at Sunday's really brilliant pitching matchup between Gerrit Cole of the Pirates and John Lester of the Cubs, and kind of the, you know, the beauty and the cruelty of baseball all rolled into one. John Lester takes a no-hitter into the seventh inning, and about an hour later, he's saddled with the loss. It's kind of unfair, but that just speaks to how well Gerrit Cole pitched. Lester was fantastic yesterday despite the loss. 6 2/3, struck out 9, gave up the one run. But is this the sharpest you've seen him this season, even with all the other good outings he's had?
Well, I know that the television commentators, Jim DeShays and Len Castro, who do the Cubs broadcast, were saying that they felt that Lester looked as good as Lester looked really good. I think he's just been good since spring training, personally. I mean, and Joe Maddon has said that repeatedly. It's just that he seems to have his delivery just in a better, I don't know what the word is, better place. I mean, his delivery is just smoother. He's mentioned a few times that last year he had, you know, his leg wasn't quite right. He just was trying to do too much. The big contract and everything was sort of getting to him. And I just think that he's just in a better place personally, and that's sort of translated into better pitching.
Yeah, it sure has. He looks mechanically smoother, as you said, and as we've talked about in previous podcasts, he's in his second year in the city with the team, with the organization, in that environment, and it's all kind of led to him having a fantastic start to the 2016 season for sure. So John Lester, again, the tough luck loss yesterday despite carrying the no-no into the seventh, and, you know, there was a lead in that seventh inning. He got the first man out. Then I believe Starling Marte was the one that broke up the no-hit bid. Then I know that he struck out Francisco Cervelli for the second out. Up comes Jungho Gong, another right-handed bat. Lester well over 100 pitches at this point. At that point, are you watching things and thinking, you know what, maybe Joe should go to the righty out of the bullpen here, or did Lester kind of earn the right to battle through and complete those seven innings?
Well, after the game, Maddon mentioned that when Lester struck out Cervelli, he thought maybe he had a chance to finish the inning. And he because he said Cervelli doesn't strike out that often, and felt that that was sort of a key at bat, and that's why he stuck with Lester for the rest of the inning. So I guess I have to go with Joe on this one.
Yeah, it's a gut call, you know, gut feeling call. And
right,
again, like you said, you know, he strikes out Francisco Cervelli. That's not an easy thing to do. Maybe he's got enough left in the tank to get Gong. That was not the case. Sometimes it works, Sometimes it doesn't. It did not yesterday for John Lester and the Cubs as they fall to the Pirates 2-1. Hats off to Gerrit Cole. As good as Lester was, Cole a little bit better. He goes 8 innings and he gets the win. Kerry, want to go back to Saturday's game, one that the Cubs won handily 8-2, but after the game is where the headlines were generated here. The Pirates were kind of chirping about Jake Arrieta intentionally hitting Jung Ho Kang with a pitch. And as soon as I heard that, I kind of rolled my eyes and I thought that was ridiculous. And I think even Joe Maddon said, look, you know, earlier in that game, Jake Arrieta walked Jeff Locke on 4, maybe 5 pitches. So even for a control artist like Arrieta, somebody who's so precise, it can get away from him, you know, even right. A guy like him. So he said, the assertion that Kang was hit intentionally, really ridiculous, and I would tend to think you would agree with that.
Yes. it really is ridiculous, and I think that fourth inning when he hit him was just Arrieta was just out of whack. And after the inning, Miguel Montero, the catcher, said he took Arrieta sort of into the tunnel out in the dugout and told him, hey, you need to start being aggressive. You need to stop trying to be so fine with your pitches. And Arrieta said that was exactly the talk that he needed. And then, boom, he went out, and I think he retired, like struck out like 7 of the next 11 batters that he faced. So he settled down. But no, I think there's – I think people are just trying to create something that isn't there, maybe, with the – I mean, it is a rivalry. It is an intense rivalry, which began – which has sort of picked up steam ever since the wild card game last October. That's when it really sort of hit the zenith. And it's why would he want to hit him? I mean, if you look at the situation in that game, there was just no reason to put another runner on base. So it's and I also think that in listening to the Pirates broadcasters, I think people are a little sensitive about Kang just because of what happened last year. So with the injury to him, Chris Coughlin, you know, when they had their collision at second base, it's not like the Cubs are out to get him. That's ridiculous. And in fact, what's really sad for the Pirates people is I wish they could hear the Cubs players and Maddon talk about the Pirates. There is nothing but respect from the Cubs side regarding Pittsburgh. Maddon just gushes about how athletic the team is, about how good they are. Cubs may be 5-1 against them this year, but they're not taking them for granted in any way.
All great points. And, you know, like you said, this is a great rivalry that's developed in the last couple seasons between the Cubs and the Pirates, but this is not Rangers Blue Jays, as we saw what happened yesterday, the punch heard around the world, seen around the world, Rougned Odor decking Jose Bautista. It's not that. You know, it's intense, but it's not crossing a line. So again, the assertion that Arrieta would do anything intentional to harm Jung Ho Kang is really ridiculous. And you brought up a good point too in saying that, you know what, the Cubs are the team that have the target on their backs. They're the best team in baseball, the best record, best run differential. You go down the list, and sometimes a team is going to do anything they can to take a shot at you to try to knock you off your pedestal, knock you off your game. Maybe this was just that sort of gamesmanship between the Pirates and the Cubs. You don't know. But, again, I think most people in baseball would agree that there was no intent whatsoever on Jake Arrieta's part in hitting Jung Ho Kang. Moving forward, Kerry, Miguel Montero, who you mentioned, is back in the fold. And the Cubs are going a rather unorthodox route here. They're carrying 3 catchers on the roster, Montero and also David Ross, who at 39 has found the fountain of youth, and again, Tim Fedorovich as well. How does Joe Maddon plan on utilizing all 3 of these guys to ensure that they all get ample playing time to keep from getting rusty?
Well, I don't think we'll have to worry about them getting rusty. I think the Cubs are a little concerned about maybe overusing Ross a little too much, so they wanted to keep Fedorovich. The other thing is Fedorovich would most likely not clear waivers if they tried to send him back to the minor league, so that's the other reason for keeping him. And what's interesting is that the Cubs really can keep 3 catchers because of the versatility of the rest of the roster. If they need to, Ben Zobrist can go from second to the outfield. Javi Baez can play third or short or second or the outfield. You know, you've got Chris Bryant, who's been moving back and forth between left field and third base. And because of all the versatility on the rest of the roster, they can afford to go with the 3. Now, they started last season with three catchers because they had Wellington Castillo and then eventually traded him. I think right now, because Montero has had a back injury, which anybody who's had a back injury knows that you have to really do your exercises and be careful with that. And because you've got Ross, who's 39, I think having a third catcher is not such a bad idea. And Fedorovich and I talked on Sunday, and he said he can play first base. He's got, he could also sub there. And the way Joe likes to do, move players around, he could come in easily late in a game. Let's say Lester pitches, goes seven innings, they take Lester out, they take Ross out, they could put Fedorovich in there if they needed to give Ross just a little bit of a break. So it just gives Joe one more piece to play with.
Mark, it would not be a true Reds podcast, of course, if we did not discuss the latest setback injury-wise to a Reds starting pitcher. It has just become ridiculous at this point, although maybe we passed ridiculous a few weeks ago. I don't know. But in any event, it's becoming an epidemic, and the latest victim to the injury bug for the Reds rotation is Tim Adelman, as he left Thursday's game against the Indians due to an injury again. What is the status of Adelman right now on this Friday, Mark?
Yeah, I wish I went to medical school. I could have really used all that medical information right about now. But Tim Adelman was just placed on the disabled list with a strained oblique, left oblique, and they called up an outfielder for at least the time being named Steve Selsky from AAA Louisville, who's been was not on the 40-man roster, so they have to corresponding move could let yet to come, and they'll have to name a starting pitcher in 4 days. But Adelman felt something on his first pitch to Jimenez last night, and then on the second pitch he really felt it, and then they decided it was time not to continue. So the replacements for the injured players are now getting injured. Adelman, of course, was here for in place of Raisel Iglesias, so they will have to reach into their system one more time to find another replacement.
It's just, like you said, it's mind-boggling. It just really makes your head spin with all these guys going down left and right and left and right. And, like you said, again, you wish you'd gone to medical school to try to better diagnose what's going on with these guys. But, I know this is a sensitive area or issue or topic, but because we've seen so many pitchers go down in the early part of the season, I mean, is it a point where we're past coincidence now and that there's something that the Reds pitchers are or aren't doing that's causing all these injuries right now? I mean, can you kind of wrap your head around this a little bit?
Well, I'm always careful. I don't want to throw things around and throw mud in the at people, but at the same time, the injuries that they're having are things like obliques and intercostals and things like that. They're not the really bad injuries. I mean, Homer Bailey is going back to last year, and he was already had one arm surgery. Raisel Iglesias is a shoulder impingement. It wasn't like a major shoulder injury. Two oblique injuries with the Discofani and Adelman. Moscott has a flare-up from his surgery from last year when he fell down trying to chase somebody down. So not all of these are the chronic arm injuries that you come to see. The Reds, for all their injuries, according to the website, there's a website that keeps track of all the, I think it's called Man Games Lost. They keep track of it. The Reds are sixth in DL time this year, so they're not the worst injured team. The Dodgers, I believe, are the worst injured team as of 2 days ago. So these things happen. It's just, unfortunately for the Reds, it's just their turn to deal with this, and they've been dealing with injuries for the last couple of seasons, and they have to find a way to work around it. Their depth was already thin, and now it's going to be tested even more. They're going to have to come up with another starting pitcher, and they're trying to stay away from the really big prospects like Cody Reed, so they're going to have to be tested again.
Yeah, that's the way it's gone. And like you said, I suppose a little silver lining in the fact that these aren't major, arm issues per se. It's other parts of the body that are affecting, their performance on the mound and their health status. So I guess in that regard, it's a serious problem. But like you said, there are five other teams in baseball with more injuries than the Reds, as hard as that may be to believe. So, again, a little silver lining for the Reds pitchers as they try to find some semblance of health for the remaining 4.5-5 months of the season. And Mark, to say the least, a very difficult week for the Reds rotation as a whole. Tuesday night, it was just all kinds of ugly for Alfredo Simon. 10 runs on 14 hits. The first pitcher, I believe, since James Shields, of all guys, in 2013 to hold that dubious distinction of giving up that many runs on that many hits in an outing. Now, what I found interesting is that despite those numbers, he actually pitched into the fifth, even though he'd already given up seven of those 10 runs through three. Is this a matter, like you've addressed before, because the depth has been so compromised that maybe Brian Price didn't feel like he had a choice, and even though he's got a guy that clearly did not have his A game, he had to send him out there for the fourth and even the fifth?
Yeah, that's exactly right. He went out to the mound at one point and said, you know, told him, reminded him of what made him successful, which was to keep his sinker down. He was unable to keep his pitches down. They were drifting up back, you know, not only up and over the plate, and they were getting hit pretty hard. But yeah, he really didn't want, after John Lamb was beat up the night before, I think he only made it four innings. He really didn't want to go into his bullpen too much. They had to go in the bullpen again on Sunday. They had to do it again Saturday. So there really was not a lot of options. And as it was, he had to still really tax his bullpen in the game after Simon left. So, yeah, this is the guy that was signed to eat the innings and be maybe the one guy that they could count on. And they haven't, other than two starts, been able to really get much out of him. So they have to find a way to get pitchers to go deeper in games so they can preserve their bullpen. You know, Brian Price last night was just saying he would love, you know, to give relievers not just a day off from pitching to get reset, but he'd like to give them 2 days off where he doesn't have to use them. You know, a nice eight-inning start or a complete game or even seven innings would be really heaven sent for him right now, and they're just not getting that from any of their starters.
It's such a shame, too, because we see in this day and age, you know, if you've just got one guy that gives you those seven, even eight innings or you know, hey, even a complete game, it can reset the bullpen very quickly. But the Reds, as you said, are simply not getting that from anybody in the rotation right now. And, of course, Mark, in that same game, that same inning where Simon was lifted with one out in the fifth, it was just a complete meltdown by Steve Delabar and really tough to watch. The guy faced six batters. He walked five. Four of them were bases loaded walks, so run score, of course. And, you know, this is a guy who, you know, limited appearances. I think it was only his seventh appearance the other night. But in the first six, he really hadn't displayed any sort of big control problems. He maybe had two walks on the season, maybe three. But, again, a guy that you would never expect to have a meltdown like that. You know, again, the five walks and the four bases loaded walks. You know, how difficult is it to watch anybody go through that on the mound when there's, you know, no help in sight, it seems?
Well, yeah, he had to eat that. There was nothing else to do. There was nothing else to say. And he really was at a loss of words. You know, talking to him afterwards, you could tell he was shaken up by it just because it's not something, even as a veteran, that you expect, you know, especially if you're a veteran. And he kind of called it a bad dream. He just couldn't believe that that was happening. And I give him credit for being accountable, for talking and explaining what he could, explaining what kind of honestly was the unexplainable. And he didn't really have an answer for it. But, right now, they don't have options. There's J.J. Hoover struggling in the minors. They just called up Kiva Sampson and Jumbo Diaz, who are pitching well in Louisville. But they, right now, they're going to have to stick with what they have and get through this. And that's the only option. As much as people say, go get someone else, there really is no one else right now for the bullpen.
It's tough. And you brought up the two names, you know, Jumbo Diaz and Kiva Sampson up from AAA. Were those the two biggest bullpen transactions this week? You know, were guys sent down? Were guys demoted? How are things kind of shaking out in the relief corps right now?
Well, they went to seven relievers for the Cleveland series in Cleveland because they had a DH. They figured if their starter could go long enough, they wouldn't have to pinch hit early for them and then use a bullpen piece. So they felt good about having seven relievers, at least up there. When they got back here, they moved out Jose Peraza and Lane Thompson and got basically an eighth reliever, and they swapped out Thompson for Diaz. And, you know, their first game, they both struggled. Diaz walked a couple of guys, led to a run that put Cleveland within one, and then in extra innings, it was a walk and a two-run homer that did in – that was, yeah, it was his first batter, I'm sorry. It was his first batter of the game. When he entered the game in the 12th, I think Thompson gave up the home run. So that's what's killing them. The Reds right now lead the majors, not only, of course, in home runs allowed and relievers allowing home runs, but they've allowed 10 home runs to first batters for the bullpen. So they have to find ways to get out, and they're not doing that.
Adam, to share your valuable free time with us is most appreciated for sure. And, Adam, I want to lead things off by talking about Chris Carter's home run Sunday versus the Padres, and I've watched this thing five or six times, Adam, and the guy barely swung. I mean, it's just it's unbelievable how much power he generates. There's all the talk about Giancarlo Stanton, Bryce Harper, Miguel Cabrera, and rightfully so. But for my money, this guy has as much, if not more, raw power than any of those guys. 443 feet, according to StatCast. And do you just marvel when you see this guy in person?
Yeah, I mean, he's a big man. He's not one of those guys where you look at him and you go, where does this power come from? You look at him and you see exactly where the power comes from. And it's a different swing from some of those other guys you mentioned. Stanton has some easy power, but when he really gets one, I mean, he also swings really hard. Harper obviously swings extremely hard. Great bat speed. Carter does this thing where it just looks like he's just, like you or I would swing a golf club, just nice and easy, and the ball explodes off his bat. And that's certainly what happened with the ball yesterday. Then he had a go-ahead double where it was the same type of thing. A real easy swing produces this laser line drive double that gave the Brewers a victory over the Padres. He is definitely the prototypical power guy in that it's hot and cold. And he was in a cold spell. It got to 0 for 23 after one at-bat yesterday before he got three hits and as many at-bats. He had worked the day before a day he was out of the lineup in the batting cage, found a little something in his swing that he thought he could focus on, took 40 or 50 swings that afternoon. He did play some in the game that night. We're talking Saturday night. Didn't get a hit, but felt better at the plate. And sometimes it's something small like that where a guy can, whether or not it's the mechanical fix is actually the thing that snaps him out, or if it's just getting something else to think about when you're up there at the plate. But whatever the reason, he was able to break out of his slump. And, I think we're going to see more of that. He's historically a guy who will hit a bunch of home runs in bunches and then go into a long cold spell. And that's kind of what we've seen already so far in his brief Brewers tenure.
And the book on him, as we've discussed numerous times, is for him to find consistency. If he can do that, he's already got 11 home runs, as many as Bryce Harper this season. So he could really become a beast in the middle of that Brewers order. And going back to that mechanical fix or that mechanical tweak, did he specify what that was or kind of leave that to the imagination?
No, he didn't specify what it was. And my guess is that it was something very small. I mean, oftentimes with guys, it'll be something with hand positioning. He talks what he referenced is just being more up the middle. And that's what you always hear from Chris Carter. That is the secret to what he's been able to accomplish so far this year. It's using the whole field. It's what every hitter wants to do. But look, he is, again, if you look at his history, he has a tendency to get pull happy. Many power hitters do. And when he's good, it's when he's driving the ball up the middle into right field. And it's one of the reasons the Brewers liked him in the offseason is that right center is a great place to hit home runs at Miller Park for whatever reasons. We'll have to bring in a meteorologist to tell us why. But the ball really flies. It's the visitor's bullpen in right center. And he's already hit some home runs in that direction. So up the middle to right, when he thinks in that direction, that's when he is able to have his success. So whatever tweak he made, it was designed to get him more up the middle, which is, it's weight or it's hands. It's something so small that you'd never see it with your naked eye. But again, it's getting something else in your head can often make a big difference for a hitter.
Yeah, absolutely can. And if this guy ever takes a Harper-esque or a Dustin Pedroia-esque swing, he might destroy StatCast. You never know. That thing could go 600, 700 feet. So maybe that day will come.
You know who he reminds me of, Matt? But from the left-handed side, we had Russell Branding in Milwaukee years ago. He once hit a home run off Greg Maddux at Miller Park. That's still the longest. And I 469, something like that. Just an absolute. It looked like it was 700 feet. I wasn't there when Cecil Fielder hit one out of Connie Stadium, but that's the right-handed home run that they always talk about in Milwaukee. The Branion one is a left-handed home run. But Branion, it was that same swing where he just takes this easy swing and you wonder, how does the ball jump off the bat like that? But when you're big and strong, I guess that's what happens.
Yeah, and that's exactly what we wonder with Chris Carter. Again, watching the highlights, and I'm thinking, why are we putting this lazy fly ball into our highlight package? And the next thing it traveled 2 miles. That's why. So he's got the muscle behind those swings, and if he ever really does decide to go all out on a swing, StatCast, look out. On the pitching end of things, Adam, we had to do kind of a double take yesterday at the sight of a Brewers starter on the mound. for the seventh inning. That was incredible. Zach Davies was the guy that did it yesterday. Turned in 6 1/3 when it was all said and done. Gave up 2 runs. Season high 6 Ks. Did not issue a walk for the first time this season. What was different about Davies yesterday as opposed to his previous 4 or 5 starts this year?
Well, he talks about having an aggressive mentality. He's the kind of guy, he doesn't blow hitters away with stuff. But when he just is a grip-it-and-rip-it guy and attacks the strike zone, he can be very difficult on him. And when he gets strike one, he can be very difficult because he has this great changeup where the batter has a hard time differentiating fastball changeup, and that 90 looks, you know, like 95 and up. So that's what he was able to do. And in the first inning yesterday, he was all fastballs. And they were well located, meaning he was ahead of hitters, and he was effective. And I think having a nice, crisp first inning propelled him into a good outing. And he's been building a little bit. He was good for the Brewers last September. He was not good when he first came up this year. But he's been building toward an outing like yesterday's. And it is a big deal for this Brewers team. They've gotten a couple nice starts now in a row from guys not named Jimmy Nelson. The one pitcher who remains lagging way behind is Willie Peralta, who we've talked about a lot. He had another very poor start against the Padres the other day, and they're having a discussion now about what to do with him. I think it's at the point where just every fifth day isn't working, and they're at least discussing alternatives, and they have a number of different alternatives, from just bumping him back a while to bumping him to the bullpen, giving him some short stints where he can just go out there and air it out, or perhaps optioning him to the minors and see what happens down there. So that's under discussion right now. The good news, though, while that position remains very much a problem, some of these other spots are starting to look a little bit better for the Brewers.